Expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Bob Chapman as well. And Bob, as you know, is the publisher and the editor of the International Forecaster, and we're going to be talking about what's happening financially, because this is so vitally important to the future of our country and of the world. And most people find it difficult to believe that the whole financial banking structure of the world is beginning to implode. And we're seeing this massive stock market drops in other countries, Turkey and certainly in the Orient and in Europe. Many of the stock markets are dropping and dropping dramatically simply within the last week. And certainly we find that many of our banks, many of the largest banks in the world, are frankly insolvent. And of course what they're trying to do is get the government to pick up their debts. We're talking about literally trillions of dollars of faulty loans out there, and then of course the debentures and all these other things that were actually encouraged by the Federal Reserve System under Alan Greenspan, a situation where, of course, people were saying, we've got to regulate the debentures, and oh no, Alan Greenspan saying, no, they're working really very, very well, we don't want to touch them at all, and of course what we're doing, in essence, is laying the foundation for the implosion of our financial system. Well, with that as the background, Bob Chapman, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to be here.
All right, fine. Will you pick up the story and bring us up to date on the latest things that are happening?
Well, I think we can look back at last Thursday's Senate hearing in which the star of the show was Chairman Ben Bernanke. And he gave a 45-minute dissertation that left the Senate stone silent, because they finally are getting the gravity of the situation and what's happening in the marketplace or in the financial world. Most of them are not financially oriented people when it comes to the markets and to finance. They essentially uneducated, we'll put it that way. And it was quite a display. He said that some of the things that we know already, which the mortgage situation and the credit crisis and Europe and their problems, which is part of the contagion, if you may, of having sold these things, better known as toxic waste, to other professionals throughout the world. And he went on to, in quite a depth of the, essentially what it sounded like was the coming of the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Now, is this a talk? Is this up on the Federal Reserve website? Or?
Yeah, it is.
All right, fine.
It's extraordinarily interesting that none of the media picked this up.
No, I didn't. Hadn't heard about it at all. Well, we'll have to go to the Federal Reserve website and get it. And did he really lay out the fact, or the implications for the collapse of the world monetary system, banking system?
Well, he brought up the problems, and he intonated that he really had no other alternatives other than the cut rates.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Okay, Bob, certainly that Bernanke was just saying he really had no alternative other than, to cut rates and pump the money into the system and try to provide increased liquidity, but that isn't going to solve the problem, is it?
No, it's not, and it didn't in the 1930s either. And they just don't know what to do. And they thought they could work their way through this monster that was created by Alan Greenspan, and they were disappointed because one analyst in New York decided that the holdings of Citigroup were not what they were made out to be, and that affected their asset value and their compilation of whether they were within the 8-to-1 ratio of lending, and another group of technical things, and that started it all. And it was something that nobody had expected to happen. Usually Wall Street keeps his mouth shut and lets the game go on, profiting as much as they can through the whole thing. And it didn't happen. One individual said, no, we ain't going to do that anymore. He was a bank analyst, a lady. And it led to the current situation, which is now 7 months old. And the situation is worse now than it was before. And so I think that Mr. Bernanke didn't say anything that you and I and many of our listeners, if not most of the listeners know already, but the Senate certainly didn't realize it, nor did they know that the situation was as dire as it is. I mean, there's no way out of this thing, and quite frankly, there hasn't since we announced it in 2002. We said, you know, there's no way back now. And they had committed themselves, and they created this real estate, and then later the creation of bonds from mortgages and sold them as AAA when in fact they probably were BBB. And now the result of that is that they're probably worth 30 cents on a dollar on average. And that's probably $1 trillion or more dollars in losses.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Bob was just saying that really there's been no way back from where we are today. Starting back in 2002, this whole idea of creating a real estate bubble and then encouraging people who could not afford to buy homes to buy homes, the so-called subprime mortgages, and then, of course, bundling these into bonds and selling them all over the world, into Japan, into Switzerland, into Europe, into the United States, and really we don't know where all of these bonds are. And it's not just simply the collateralized debt obligations of mortgages on homes, but then we have the similar bonds made up of students, student loans. But a lot of the students are not paying on their loans, and so those are going to go into default. And then they're made up of automobile loans and truck loans. And, of course, a lot of people are not able to keep up with that, especially as they're losing their jobs and prices are going up and so many other things. And what do? They just don't pay their debt. They give up their car. And now you've got all these other non-performing bonds out there. And, of course, this has a profound impact. If you have you're a bank and you have to have 8% of the money you have lent out, in cash or in AAA bonds, and you suddenly find all your AAA bonds are really BBB or junk bonds, and then what do you do? Well, pick up the story there, Bob.
Well, there's not much you can do. You've got this loss, and worse than that, there's no market for your inventory, for your product, for your collateralization for your investment. There is no market. And it's not only there. You've got the same thing going on in the municipal bond market. You've got the same thing going on in commercial paper. And that's been going on for 7 months, and it just deteriorates every day. Because what people did in business, and this was very, very common, they would put up collateral and a combination of different types of paper. And, you know, there was nothing ever said until the collateralized debt obligation come along. And out of about $2.3 trillion in commercial paper, about $1.1 trillion was this collateralized debt obligation. And the lenders don't want to lend any more money to people with that kind of collateral. And so the upshot is we have another frozen market. So there's three right there. And I'm sure that the market in the stock market would be considerably lower were it not for the intercession into the marketplace of the Federal Reserve and the lending a tremendous amount of credit to institutions, which in turn, usually banks as lenders, in turn to others who invest and speculate in the stock market.
And, of course, they keep the price up artificially, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. And what's happened is that the professional traders are ready to throw it in because they can't make a living because what the market should do, it does not do, and they end up losing money and not making any money, which is probably just as bad. And they're unhappy, and they know what's going on. They just don't know what to do about it because nobody wants to blow the whistle. Because if the Fed doesn't go in the market, where will the Dow be? It won't be at 12,500. It might very well be at 4,200.
Well, no, Chris, my understanding is that in many other countries throughout the world that do not have a plunge protection team or organization like the Working Group on Financial Markets, you know, that in other countries like Turkey and Russia and a lot of these countries, the market is dropping and dropping precipitously. Is that right?
Well, they're all down, and they have been for the last several months, and particularly January was a very bad month, 5, 6, 7% to the downside. And one of the things that came out of the G10 meeting that was just held this past weekend was that the comment was made that, in essence, we're going to go and do what the Fed's doing. We're going to get into our markets and make sure they don't collapse. And so I don't know if they legally have the ability to do that, but I think they're going to do it. And so you're going to see a big round of support in markets here starting in, when the markets open up tomorrow.
All right, fine. So you're talking about now markets throughout the world, stock markets throughout the world, they're going to manipulate those to keep them from falling, is that it?
Yeah, that's what I understand. And the Fed is also lending money to European banks as well as the European Central Bank. Now, the way I understand it, the European Central Bank cannot do what the Fed does, and that is to create money and credit in order to influence the system. And what I think in lieu of that is happening is that the Fed is giving the money to the European Central Bank, who in turn is lending it out. And the European Central Bank has admitted, and they kept this a secret up until about a week ago, that they saved Spanish lenders who were upside down as a result of the housing boom and the excesses in that boom in Spain. And now we're starting to see the same thing in Ireland, where the Dublin Institute said yesterday that they felt that there would be a 50% drop in Irish housing. And the same thing is going to happen in Spain. One of the markets that really surprises me is Germany, which rates really didn't go up at all. And even that market is soft. So I think Europe's going to have a hard time where they try to even things out. It's not working this time.
Well, I was read someplace where the our Federal Reserve System was lending money to Credit Suisse, which is the, I think, one of the two largest banks over there in Switzerland. Why would our Federal Reserve be lending money to a major Swiss bank? We're talking about billions of dollars, I think $10, $20 billion, something like that.
Well, the reason why is that obviously they needed it, and the Fed can readily do that.
But, of course, this is where is the money coming from? They're just creating it out of nothing, aren't they? Just as
that's
they always
right.
do. It's just, and isn't that highly inflationary as far as
it
we're
surely
concerned?
Is. Inflation right now is 11.6% if you use the formula that was used in 1980. After that, they changed the formula a number of times. And the whole thing is just totally distorted, and it was done deliberately. I think the main premise on the CPI was government didn't want to pay out what they were supposed to pay in inflation-related figures
for the
pensions
people on
and Social Security.
For the, yes, older people on Social Security were supposed to, you know, get their amount of money, whatever inflation was, that was supposed to be increasing their check, but what you do is you lie about the figures and then you don't have to give the older people the increase in Social Security. Because it's really only a welfare check anyway. It really has nothing to do with the welfare, pardon me, with the Social Security Fund, because there is no Social Security Fund. It's all been, that money's all been spent on wars and other excesses by the federal government through the years. Well, certainly, as this whole thing unfolds, suddenly we find that so many of the major banks in the world are insolvent. And if the major banks are insolvent, can you bail all of them out financially? We know certainly that many of the banks here in the United States want the government to pick up all of their bad loans to try to stabilize the system.
Well, an indication of that is the additions recently to the Fed site on the FDIC and how they stand ready to pay out immediately up to $100,000 on each account. And what they're doing there is they're telling you that there's going to be some problems and banks are going to go under. I think that what the Fed will do with larger banks is merge them or they'll nationalize them. Now, in England, we just saw the nationalization of Northern Rock, which is a bank. And I think you're going to see that in the United States. I had predicted this some time ago. And I didn't think it would happen so quickly, but it is, and I think that they're going to continue along that path, and perhaps in America they'll probably end up with 15 or 20 or 25 banks, and then a smattering of smaller ones. Now, the same thing happened under the FFLIC during the 1980s, during the savings and loan crisis, which cost about $500 million, which incidentally we called 3 years before it happened and said that the losses would be about $500 million. And, of course, very few were listening. But that's always the way when you're ahead and you've got the answers and very few other people have contributed answers like that.
Of course, an awful lot of people invested in savings and loan lost an awful lot of money at Lincoln Savings and some of the others, which they thought was insured, and the money really wasn't insured, was it?
No, it wasn't. People get caught, people with certificates of deposit, they just get in line with the other creditors, and you don't have much protection there, and the same is true at the bank. And $100,000 is it.
Yeah, because one of the things you pointed out is that they, although they're supposed to pay you immediately if the bank goes down, there's no guarantee they will, that they could pay you out over a period of many years as the inflation continues eroding the value of your dollar, so eventually you end up getting paid, dollars that are worth, 30-40% of their value at this time. Just as they delay, they're paying. Can they really do that?
They can do anything they want.
We'll be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman, talking about what's going on, what most people don't understand. The financial system is imploding. We'll go right ahead, Bob.
Well, as I said, they can do anything they want. We've seen a perfect example of that over the last several years, and that is that there's been new laws put into place that supersede old laws, which deprive the country, its inhabitants, of their constitutional rights. And the people who are in Congress and the executive branch today don't care about that. And, to use an old phrase, it's going to come to no good end. And I think we have such a thing coming.
Well, of course, one of the interesting things that certainly General Motors admits to losing $37 billion last year. That's $37 billion of operations, here in the United States. And then, of course, it's going to cost them another couple of $100 billion to buy off the banks, pay off the unions. They're going to pick up General Motors' obligations for health care benefits and pension for its retired workers. Where's all that money going to come from? I mean, you don't keep, because they don't have $200 billion in the piggy bank someplace, do they?
No, they don't. And it's just like the pension plans. Many of them are holding interest in hedge funds, illiquid commercial real estate, and also they're invested in collateralized debt obligations. And probably anywhere between 3% and 10% of their assets. You've got a group like CalPERS in California that they were extremely aggressive in every field, so they could bring back returns of 11 or 12%. Well, when the market goes bad, you get a problem. And the problem is that, when it's not working, the return drops down to zero or something. And so they run into trouble because they can't have the returns that are necessary to meet future obligations. As it is, the average pension plan has 75 to 80% of what is needed over a long period of time to pay off people who are going to receive this pension plan money. And if you get a frozen bond market and a falling stock market, what they had before was inadequate. They might drop down to 40 or 50% of the assets that they should have to make their payout.
So what do you do then? You're the pension fund. You've only got 40 to 50% of the assets that you need to fund the pensions you're obligated to provide. What do you do?
Well, you fund what you can at the moment, and you kind of cross your fingers and hope for the best, because that's where it's going to end up. And we saw the stock market on the Dow go to 7286 in 2001, and we went up 50% from there, and now we're back down, not as much.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob was simply talking about the major pension funds like CalPERS and here in California, the major pension funds, certainly corporate pension funds, municipal, state pension funds, and a lot of these are underfunded, maybe 20%, which is, well, that's not too bad, but if they have been aggressive and they bought these collateralized debt obligations or the asset-backed securities or the structured investment funds, all of these very risky investments, which many of the pension funds have done because they wanted to get a good return, 11-12%, and suddenly they find that all these things they bought really are not worth anywhere near what they paid for them, and nobody else wants to buy them. And then, of course, but Bob, do you really think they're going to let the stock market go down? Certainly the Plunge Protection Team, the Working Group on Financial Markets has been in there, maintaining artificial levels for our stock market, so the price-earnings ratios are all out of kilter. They're certainly half of what they should be, or twice of what they should be, 20, 25 to 1, something like that. I mean, do you think that they really are going to let the stock market go down? Because this would create panic in the minds of the American people, and that's the last thing they want, is for the people to panic or to realize how bad things really are.
Well, I think the path that they have chosen is to try to save the stock market and to keep us from doing that. And in the process, they have abandoned the dollar. Now, that's a pretty sharp sword on each side. You can't do both, because you're creating tremendous inflation, and you may keep the stock market afloat by creating all this money and credit, but what's going to happen when the liquidity, this excess liquidity, hits the economy, and which it's in the process of doing right now. As I said earlier, 11.6% is where I think inflation is. And they're already paying a price for what they've been doing for the last 4 years. And I might add that other central banks are averaging about 14%. China,
so
you're
talking
Russia,
about 14% inflation in China and Russia? And
increase in money and credit.
All right, fine.
Yeah, the inflation, let me see, I think in China is 6.8, and it's around 8% in Russia.
Right.
And but the creation of money and credit is higher numbers than that for those two. European Central Bank and the Bank of England right now are 11.7, the last figures we had. And that's down from 12.3 for both. But the Bank of England had been up at 13.3, somewhere up in that area.
Now, speaking of inflation, you're speaking of the creation of money and credit, which will, down the line, be, of course, reflected in inflation. Because inflation has nothing to do with rising prices. It has to do with increasing the money supply. And, of course, when you increase the money supply, then you drive prices up.
That's right. And that's what I alluded to at the beginning of the program, is just simply no way out. And I think that's what Mr. Bernanke was trying to impress upon the Senate the other day, and last Thursday. And there is no way out. And they're going to have to tough it through, but the result is going to be a very deep recession, if not depression. And nobody wants to talk about it, and just like when we called the top of the real estate market and told everybody who wanted to get out to get out, nobody wanted to hear about it. And that's just human nature. That's just the way people are. And that's what we're facing again in a different way.
All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest is Bob Chapman, and we're talking about what's happening financially. And the fact that we certainly are going to have a severe recession or depression if we ever hope to begin to get rid of all this tremendous amount of artificial money that they've created. We've got to get back to some sort of a solid form of currency, as outlined in our Constitution, where, of course, it states that all money will be either gold or silver coinage. It has to be built upon something, and you can't simply allow them to create monopoly money, which is what they are doing. Massively expanding the amount of money and credit. And of course, you know, wheat is up to $16.50 a bushel, and of course it's going to be reflected in everything that has wheat in it. I mean, you're going to see $5 a loaf bread. You're going to see, of course, the price of oil continue going up, but because, of course, the dollar decreases in value, the oil companies, the oil nations are going to have to get more money one way or another. Well, we'll be back in just a moment. Our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-800-464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Bob. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Well, is the Chinese economy is really doing pretty well, though, aren't they? Aren't they increasing their production year by year? Their markets are growing?
Well, yes. I think the growth this year probably would be 9%. And they've been talking about a lower growth rate for some time. I think next year it'll be probably around 5 or 6%, and they have tremendous internal possibilities for demand. And when you have that kind of in your back pocket, it's good because you can always turn inward to your own economy to keep the situation going. The weak point in China is really their banking system. They've got a lot of bad debts. Over $1 trillion, and they're in, I think, the same position Japan was in 1992, and they're going to eventually try to spend their way out of it, and it's not going to work. And so I think everybody's going to have their own set of problems. Some of them will be very similar, but no one's going to escape this. You get the United States, which is the biggest market in the world, and when we get sick, the whole world does too. And so I think it's going to be the miserable content is going to be roundly shared with everybody in the world, and it's already showing up. In Europe and in Asia, but particularly in Europe. In Canada, I just saw the production figures yesterday, and they have fallen off dramatically in Quebec and in Ontario, which we predicted. And the reason why is that they're large producers of vehicles and other manufactured items. And, of course, the sale of those has fallen, and that's bad news for them, and they're going to suffer like the states of Michigan and Ohio, Indiana, upstate New York, Chicago, Kansas City. They've all been hit very, very hard, and that will continue, and it will continue in Canada. They're blaming it in Canada on a higher dollar. Canadian dollar, and I don't think.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
That's just the case.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess Bob Chapman and Bob. Before we go on, I want you, Chris, to give us information on how people can get copies of the International Forecaster and perhaps want to subscribe to it.
Well, you can get introductory copies. By going to our website. We publish by email twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays, usually about 30 pages. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month as well. It's about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues. That site address is theinternationalforecaster@yahoo.com. That's incorrect. TheInternationalForecaster.com. TheInternational, FORECASTER.com. The email address is International_Forecaster@Yahoo.com. International_Forecaster@Yahoo.com. And we also have a toll-free number that you can call and get free copies as well, and that is 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, this caller had called and said that real estate prices have dropped about 18%. How much more do you think they're going to drop? And, of course, that's really not every place. I mean, certainly a lot of places, they have not dropped yet, but, of course, a lot of properties aren't selling. I know here in Santa Cruz, the properties aren't selling, but I don't think the prices are down very far yet. But they're going to have to fall, because if you can't sell your house, you want to sell it, you just got to drop the price until you finally get someone to buy it. So how far down do you think prices are going to go here in the United States overall?
Well, in California, they'll go down anywhere between 35% and 55%, depending location and how much they went up in value in the first place. And the other hot 30 cities of the recent years, I believe that they will go down about 35% to 40%. And other experts are now talking in the same vein as I have. The rest of the country, it depends on what your market has done. If you live in a city where prices went up 5 or 10% instead of 130 or 40 or 50, well, you don't have much downside. You might have 5% or 10%, and that's it. And so, if it didn't go up, it won't go down very much.
Okay, fine. Well, let's go to Ed, who's calling from up around Utica, New York. Hi, Ed. How you doing?
Dr. Stan, it's great to talk to you again. I certainly appreciate your program, and I try to listen as often as I can. I just have a question for Bob Chapman, and what I observed the last week in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article, an extensive article about gold, and they were saying that the gold was going to hang around 900. Is this something that's possible for them to hold it in that vicinity?
No, and you've got to remember, they started manipulating gold in 1987 when we had the crisis on October the 13th of that year, and they did it illegally, and they did it through the Bank of England. I was there at the time. And during the years since, from time to time, they would be sellers or leasers of gold. And when you lease gold, it gets sold. And they hold it on their books as not having been sold, but in reality it has. And they won't adjust that. They know people like me and other professionals know what they're doing, but they don't care, because the general public and the general mass of people within the banking and brokerage industry, they don't want them to know that. But I think that the central banks are running out of gold, are running out of as much gold as they want to, or that they dare sell.
Mm.
And I think we're coming to that juncture. Every time gold looks like it's getting ready for another move, we have an IMF announcement that they're going to sell some gold. And, of course, that has to be okayed by the United States Senate for the American participation. And that may or may not be passed legislatively. I think it depends upon what Harry Reid wants, and he comes from the biggest mining state in the country. And so I would think politically, I don't think that you'd see Harry allowing that gold to be sold. But be as it may, they're talking 400 or 500 tons. And it'll quickly be absorbed. The market doesn't seem to have taken any great notice of it, because it's traded since the announcement in a $10 or $15 range. And so with that said, nothing's going to stop this gold market. People want out of currencies. It's not just the dollar. The pound and many others have problems. And I think people would want a larger percentage of their assets in gold. And I think that that accumulation, particularly in the physical market, is going to continue unabated. And when gold pulls back, they just buy more. And there's a ready market there. And that's going to continue based upon official inflation since 1980. Gold should be selling somewhere in the vicinity of $2,268 an ounce. If you use real inflation, it's over $3,000. And so I don't think they're going to be able to hold it down here at $900. I don't think they're going to be able to take it back to $500 or $600 or $700. And I believe that gold is relentlessly going to go higher because fundamentally, it's simply underpriced in a big way.
And I think, Ed, you can't believe everything you've read in the Wall Street Journal. It's part of the establishment, and they got fascinating articles, but don't believe them. Remember, they're manipulating your mentality, just as they try to manipulate it by these massive gold sales or talking about them, trying to scare you into the fact that the price is going to fall. So, unfortunately, you can't trust the Wall Street Journal, but you can't trust most of the media. It's all controlled by the people of great wealth who are really are in the process now of accumulating gold. And they want it, and of course they're going to buy it as cheaply as they can. They don't want it going up until they've got, you know, every ounce that they can get their hands on. Okay, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. There's one other question I do have. Is it okay?
Okay, go ahead.
It seems to me that lowering the rediscount rate is not going to work, because I think that the whole purpose was to stimulate the economy here, and it's not the economy here that's going to be stimulated. It's going to be an overseas economy, isn't it?
Bob?
Well, it's not working. As you see, the economy continues to deteriorate, and has for some time. You know, at least for the last 2 years, the increase in money and credit, not only in the American economy, 18 of the top 20 central banks have been doing the same thing. And they're not having any success either. So we're headed, you know, for that cliff. And falling off reminds us of 20 or 25% inflation.
I think that what they're trying to do is increase liquidity. In other words, trying to put, by lowering the discount rate, rediscount rate there, they're trying to get more money into the economy. But the problem is not a matter of liquidity. The problem is a matter of solvency. And most of our major financial institutions are insolvent because they bought the toxic waste. That's where the problem is. They're going to try to give you the feeling they're doing something, but in reality, it's not going to work. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Ed. Please
thank
keep
you
listening.
Much,
get everybody up there.
Thank you.
God bless. And get everybody up there in Utica listening. Let's go to Will calling from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are we doing?
I'm doing very good, Dr. Stan. And Bob, this morning on Derry Brownfield's show, he reported on a WorldNet Daily article written by Jerome Corsi, where the G7, which just had their meeting, and of course Joan Vion didn't go to this one, so we don't have the inside scoop, but according to this, I haven't read the article myself, this Corsi article, G7 is planning to sell gold in March or April, if my notes are correct, to drive the price down to the $500 level. Now, you've just gone into a lengthy expose as to why that's not likely to happen, but have you had an opportunity yet to see this article by Corsi?
Well, it's one of two articles, and the source of the prognostications was not Jerome. He was just the writer.
Okay.
Mike Balsa was the one who said it was going down. And unfortunately for Mr. Balsa, he's been wrong about everything for the last several years. And so I personally, having read his production, don't agree with him at all.
Okay, does that answer your question, Will?
In fact, I'm very surprised Jerome did the article without saying something to me, because that's not going to happen, and it's not going to make Jerome look good. And just as you said, Jerome said it. Well, Jerome didn't. but he's going to get stuck with it.
I think he might.
Okay, thanks very much, Will.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye. Then let's go to Mike calling. Once again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We have Mike calling. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question for Bob?
One question. Lately, they've been giving us this definition of a recession as being two quarters in a row of negative GDP. Is this a lot of smoke and mirrors?
Yes, it is. My guideline is anything under 2% growth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have it for three straight quarters, you've got a serious problem.
Yeah.
And you got to remember the government lies about all the figures that they're giving you.
Of course,
you really don't know what it is. I mean, the quarter before, they had GDP at 3.8%. Then they talked about 0.6%. In the fourth quarter, and that doesn't make any sense.
Well,
how do you go from? It's just like your figures on productivity, almost 5%, and it drops down to 1.5%. Things don't happen that way. A long-term productivity growth in the United States has been 2.5%. That's what you got to look for. And incidentally, back in the 1990s, Alan Greenspan justified all that was going on is a productivity miracle. He said productivity was 6 and 7%. He couldn't have been more wrong. And he was lying.
Well, Bob, certainly when we talk about a GDP going up, say, 2%, does that take into account inflation? Because with inflation running 11%, a GDP rise of 2% or 3%, what you're really doing is seeing a fall of somewhere between 7 or 8%.
That's right. And the only thing that can help the increase in inflation is when you have high productivity. So if inflation is 4.3% and they say productivity has increased 4.3%, then there really is no inflation. And, of course, that's not true. I mean, they say all kinds of things that aren't true. And, you know, if you go to college and you take Echo 1 and Echo 2, and you turn around and you go back 3 or 4 years later and take the same two courses over again, you find them like night and day. I mean, these professors change their ideas like we change our socks.
Okay, anything else,
well,
Mike?
Well, now, they also talk about the ratio of a national debt, and I'm talking about the $9 trillion-plus figure. The ratio of that to GDP, they try and say, is, well, that's not so bad. Even though it's a $9 trillion-plus, it's not so bad because we got to some sort of a healthy ratio. Is this another bunch of malarkey?
Scam.
Yeah.
And, of course, really, the national debt...
It's just like, Stan, the people on the Titanic says, well, we only hit one iceberg. We're okay.
Yeah.
And, of course, the trouble is, of course, that the gross national debt, that the one they give you, has very little to do with the real debt, which is up to $50 to $60 trillion when you take into all, of course, the Social Security and Medicare and Medicare drug benefit programs we've guaranteed to fund. And certainly when the corporation has to come up with its figures, they have to take into account its future costs. Here in America, we totally ignore them. That's what's so incredible. And I see that David looks like David Walker is going to resign as head of the custodian of the currency or whatever he is, you know, because and he's going to try to tell the American people that we are totally bankrupt. He's talking about, a family of four has a debt of somewhere about over $400,000. Our share of this, the real national debt, not the phony one that they put out. But they never want to talk about that. And they never want to talk about the fact that a lot of that debt is the Social Security fund that they've already spent the money on. Anything else, Mike?
Good enough for now. Thanks a lot.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we've got Rick calling from Texas. Hi, Rick. Do you have a question?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Do you have a question?
Sorry, I was turning my radio down.
All right, fine.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot. There's a lot more volume on the silver and gold, and I've noticed it's been like big. It works its way up, and then big chunks it goes down. And is that people sell, institutional selling, or is that just manipulation, or a little of both?
Well, I just think it's the ebb and flow of the market overall, because it's a fairly deep and viable market. But I think the important thing in there is to look at is the commercial short position, and it's very important because it's at close to record levels in both silver and gold, but particularly in gold.
But isn't that an effort to drive the price down?
Yes, that's correct. The professionals who are very well financed, they believe that prices are going lower. Now, this has been persisting here for about 2 months, and it's unabated. I'm very, very surprised that the short position among the pros.
Hey, we're out of time. Thanks very much, Rick. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Bob Chapman. Bob, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up our program for it.
Well, I'll continue to answer that question. And what is happening is that it is my suspicion that the government is working with the commercials. It is not normal for commercials to be that short. And then on top of it, for so long. And, you know, the question arises, what do they know that we don't know? And I think they're working in tandem with the government. I don't think they want to be there in that position. And I think they're being guaranteed against losses. That's what I think is going on. And so that is probably the most important thing in that market. But every time that the commercials try to knock gold back down along with the United States government, this tremendous physical selling, buying comes into the market. And that's extraordinarily powerful and very potent. The only way that that market can eventually be defeated and moved up on the upside is by tremendous physical offtake. And that is happening. And has been happening for some time.
But tremendous physical offtake. Are you talking about people actually taking delivery of their products, gold and silver?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Taking delivery.
But who's actually buying at the present time? Is this the international financiers? Is this the people of great wealth? Who's doing the buying? That's the $64,000 question.
Well, we have seen large buying coming out of the Middle East. Has been the one number one customer in the last several months. We see Asian buying, not so much as usual by India, which has been the leader all the way up. They're kind of taking a rest, so to speak, to see if there will be a retrenchment. And then you get the buying coming out of Russia. And, of course, all these parties are getting ready of dollars, because gold trades in dollars, and they continue with this buying every time there's a dip. And I just think gold is going higher here. It's got all the fundamentals working for it, and the basic technical tenets are there. The longer it stays in this area or above 900, the better it is, because what it's essentially doing is forming a base.
We're out of time, Bob. Goodbye. Bye-bye. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Bob Chapman, and we like to have him on every several weeks to keep us appraised of what's really going on, because you have to understand what's happening financially, or you may very well be, like most Americans, totally wiped out in the coming financial tsunami. which of course brings me to the fact that we've given a talk called The Financial Tsunami. It's available on video or in CD, and it has a syllabus that comes with it if you want to get that. We think it's vitally important that you understand that we're in the perfect financial storm, as Ben said, and everything is coming together and everything is on the verge of collapse. We have never been in a situation this bad, perhaps since the 1930s, and there are many of the people a lot smarter than I am, Harry Schultz and Jim Rogers, who really think that we're moving into a major depression here in the United States. Stephen Roach thinks that things are really very bad. He was the chief economist for Morgan Stanley for many years. So if you'd like to get, of course, the talk on the financial tsunami, or the syllabus that goes with it, or the pamphlet we put together on the history of money, or on the financial Armageddon, why we certainly recommend these. And give us, if you'd like more information, you can call 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We have a four tape or four CD set called Financial Armageddon. That's Financial Armageddon, because I believe we are on the edge of a financial Armageddon, quite simply. And then, of course, we want to mention we have a great new four-tape or four-CD set entitled Planned Police State, the Planned Police State, because everything is in place. I mean, why do you think they're putting all these video cameras up all across our country? Why do you think that they've put into your cell phone, if you have a modern-day cell phone, a little microphone there so that even if your telephone is not turned on, they can listen to your conversations. They can track where you are. If you have it with you, even though it's turned off, they can track your every movement. Why do you think that they've taken the satellites that we put up in the sky to spy on the communists, and now we're spying on the American citizens? You must understand that nothing is as it appears to be. There is a plan for a police state. The concentration camps are ready. Many of them are already built. Others are being refurbished at the Japanese concentration camps. And the others, of course, they've given Halliburton $385 million to stand by for 4 years to be ready to build massive numbers of concentration camps in America. Why would they be doing that? Who's going to go into those camps? Well, you need to get the four-tape set, Planned Police State. We also have a concentration camp special, which has all sorts of videos and DVDs and four tape sets of it. You need to get the information. You need to help us get the information out across America. And of course, we have a great new four tape set on four CD set on weather modification, a book by that title, a DVD by that title, by DVD put out by our friend Bob Pletcher. We also have a four-tape set on the RFID chip. We call it the Spy Chips. And we also have a book called Spy Chips, certainly by Catherine Albrecht and Liz. And then, of course, we also have a new four-tape set on the four-CD set on the Bilderbergers. And, of course, we have a four-CD set. We have a DVD called Endgame that goes into the Bilderbergers, two books, one called Bilderbergers, the other Bilderberger Diary, and then, of course, for the satanic nature of the Bilderbergers, the book Satanic Crimes and or the four tapers, four CD set, Satanic Crimes by William H. Kennedy. The information is there. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you want to contact us, if you'd like a free newsletter, free catalogs on emergency storage or on health products or simply on the products that we have that for education, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is under attack today. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. And we'll be back in just a moment with Barry Shamish. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barry Shamish. And Barry's an Israeli patriot who's really, of course, been an investigative reporter in Israel for many years and has written a number of excellent books. And certainly he's been trying to point out the corruption in the Israeli government, the fact that the people who are leading Israel are controlled in large part by either the Vatican or by people here in the United States in the Council on Foreign Relations, and they are intent upon the destruction of the State of Israel. Of course, the average Israeli doesn't understand that. They don't understand that these are ruthless people, and they kill people who get in the way. In fact, that's why Barry's living in the United States today, because certainly his life was in danger. And he's written extensively about the murder of Rabin, the Israeli foreign premier, and of course about the murders of so many other people. He's written a wonderful book I have right in front of me called Bye Bye Gaza, and it talks about the murders of many, many people who tried to do what was right for Israel and were certainly destroyed in one way or another. Anyway, with that as a background, Barry Shamish, thanks very much for being with us again.
Yeah, always a pleasure. You know, our last show, I sent you the email about the PLO being sued in the United States.
Right, uh-huh.
That issue, I didn't even know that this week that issue would become...
Oh, go right ahead.
Just that Rice and Bush are going to intervene with the courts on behalf of the PLO and let the victims go without compensation. Well, essentially because the PLO would be bankrupted by all the victims of their terrorism if these court cases went for the plaintiff. It's that simple. And this week, Bush and Rice have announced that they'll investigate the court cases, and I sent you this along just to let you know how really on we were with the interview last week.
Well, I think for our listeners out there, basically what happened is that, at least in this instance, there were Americans who were the families of people who were killed or by the PLO were going to sue the PLO. Well, you have to understand that the United States backs both the PLO terrorist organizations and Israel. This is the same technique. It's been around for a long time. And I mean, every time, of course, the PLO is about ready to be wiped out, we've rescued them. We've done this time and time again. We finance both sides in most wars, and here we're financing the Israelis, and then we've financed the people who are trying to destroy the Israelis. And the last thing that, of course, our leaders want are for these lawsuits to be effective, and of course people to be granted a judgment against the Palestinian Liberation Organization, because we're funding it, and we don't want to have to actually give the money to these people who've been killed or families of people who've been killed by the PLO that we're financing. But you pick up the story there.
Well, the judgments are in. The PLO, $200 million. That's what they owe in the States, and the judges put liens on their bank accounts, and really it's a very effective tool to stop terrorism if every time they kill somebody they have to pay millions and millions of dollars. And we spoke about the Israeli judge who did the same thing, and they killed him. And, well, timing is what it is. That issue came up this week that, well, for the states to actually give foreign aid to the PLO, which is going to be handed over to their victims.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
All right.
Okay, Barry, go ahead. Pick it up.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be handed over to the victims. Why give foreign aid? It doesn't make a lot of sense. So the issue of killing Judge Azar is not a small issue. It's right on the hot burner right now.
All right, friend. And first, the judge Azar was an Israeli judge who, of course, granted judgments against the PLO for the murder of Israelis. And so it's very similar, whether you get judgments against the PLO for killing Israelis or judgments against the PLO for killing Americans. In Israel, the judge Azar, was simply killed. And, of course, it's an incredible story of how it was not only he was killed, but then the lawyer for one of the killers was obviously assassinated. They tried to make it appear to be a suicide, but it wasn't a suicide at all. You don't suicide yourself by shooting yourself in the middle of the forehead. You put the gun into your temple or in your mouth, but not in the middle of your forehead. Anyway,
well,
go ahead.
Well, the killer, story. I'd say patsy would be a better definition.
Right.
Before we go on to another murder this week, these are all from my book Bye-Bye Gaza. The first chapter has Judge Azar and has Raful Eitan, which we'll hit. But I've got to go over this week's news, or I would be remiss. So I'll do that as fast as I can. The first thing, I suppose it would interest you, I'm not sure really if I'm that interested, but nonetheless, Israel had an earthquake this week, and only two spots were damaged. One was just outside Joseph's tomb in Nablus, and one was on the Temple Mount. There was a hole in the Temple Mount about 5 feet in diameter from the earthquake. And these are the only spots in all of Israel that were damaged by this earthquake. Now, many, many people have said that this earthquake was sending a message. And I had this argument over the Internet. What would the message be to put a hole in the Temple Mount? Now, really, you got to figure there are a lot of places where the earthquake could have hit. The fact that it hit next to the Shrine of Omar, when you think of all the lawns and ditches and fields wherever that it could have hit, it hits right in the middle of the Temple Mount. It's kind of uncanny.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. We'll be right back with Barry Samish here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Barry wanted to give us a rundown on the latest news out of Israel. And he's simply pointing out that there was an earthquake in Israel this week, but it only seemed to hit in two places and produce damage. One of them was adjacent to Jacob's tomb, which is a holy site, and then, of course, the other was on the Holy Mount, right adjacent to the Mosque of Omar. Now, when this earthquake hit, why, of course, it actually opened up an area of dirt, earth about 5 feet across, and they put all sorts of pieces of wood. I've actually seen the pictures of the hole, that great big hole, and they're covering it over with wood. But why would this earthquake have only hit in those two places, adjacent to Jacob's tomb and adjacent to the Mosque of Omar? Now, there are many, many people who believe that the mosque is going to have to be destroyed so that the temple can be, rebuilt. Is that true, or can they build the temple on the temple square without destroying the Mosque of Omar? Under any circumstances, we know that the Arabs, the Muslims, have been building tunnels underneath that whole area there, and certainly that has weakened it. But Barry's point is, isn't it strange that only two places in Israel the earthquake hit? Both are holy places for Israel, and I would, of course, say that I would give it a great deal of spiritual significance. Barry, you're sort of unequivocal on that, Barry.
Well, I don't know. But first of all, it's Joseph's tomb.
Joseph's tomb, I'm sorry.
Jacob's is the cave of the patriarchs right. In Hebron.
And the other is up in there in Samaria, isn't it?
It's near Nablus.
Okay, it is.
And it's not a mosque. It's a shrine of Omar. The mosque is Al-Aqsa. But nonetheless, that's where it hits. And look, I asked what the message could be. I mean, really, what's the message? And I got the answer from a lady who runs a news group who fills me in with the latest. The answer is that we the Jews, of course, should be taking back our Temple Mount. And this was God giving us a message. I'm sure there's many other interpretations. The Muslims think that Israel did it somehow. And I think that's possible. I mean, if not, then it truly was some sort of divine earthquake. Which, by the way, I'm not completely discounting that possibility. But that's this week's earthquake in Israel. They think the next one will weaken the whole Temple Mount, and down will come the shrine and the mosque, and who knows?
And boy, would that get the Arabs and the Muslims mad?
Well, I don't think you don't have to worry about that right now, because the killing of this Imad Mughniyeh seems to be doing the trick right now.
This is the fellow that they was killed by some sort of a bomb up there in Damascus, right?
Well, yeah. Now, I've been reading the reports, and if I'm not there, I don't like to read reports. But nonetheless, the Syrians claim, this is unbelievable actually, the Syrians claim Hezbollah did it, and Hezbollah claimed the Syrians did it, but Iran certainly thinks Israel did it, and then the Telegraph in England, which is more reliable than other English papers, nonetheless interviewed their Mossad connections, and the claim is the Mossad did it, and they replaced the headrest on Mughniyeh's car with an explosive headrest and blew his head off, and this has made headlines all through Europe. I don't know, I've never seen it in the States, but it's certainly what the Arabs believe, and they are really, really preparing for war now, in a big way, and it's palpable now. The threats are every which way. Now Israel is also preparing for war, and they're preparing it in a way I've never seen a war prepared. Israel used to rely on the surprise attack. This is how we won, as a matter of fact. We determine the time and the place, and you don't give the other side enough time to prepare properly. This is how we won when we used to win. That was the Six-Day War, as one example of a surprise attack. Well, the IDF are now warning the Israeli population that there's going to be a war. Now, I don't know if you saw their war plan. I certainly did. And it's a nasty, nasty plan. Apparently it's being done in the greatest of secrecy by two morons, Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, which is already a lot of trouble. You don't let these people anywhere near a war. And they're supposedly doing it in secrecy with the top echelons of the IDF, which today, again, who trusts them? But nonetheless, what they have released, they've warned all Israelis in the south of the country, anywhere near Gaza, that they'll have to remain in shelters for a minimum of 2 weeks after the war starts because of the rockets that are going to be blasted at them. And that's already not a six-day war. When they're warning people 2 weeks minimum of rockets, that's assuming things go well. They're also preparing for riots throughout the West Bank, which, by the way, is not such an easy thing to quell. But that's in the war plans.
Well, these would be Palestinians who would be rioting, right?
Who else?
All right, fine. And then, Chris, the other thing interesting that I've been reading, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this, was that it is said that the Olmert had said that they would not attack Gaza militarily unless they were guaranteed that, when they pulled back, that there'd be a United Nations force to come in and occupy the area. Had you read that?
Yeah, that's in the war plan. They're preparing the world, supposedly, and you're going to get foreign troops. guarding the crossings and the Philadelphia corridor and all this. That's in the war plan as well. That's what the government says. Remember, this was released to the Israeli people, and I read this over Yediot Ahronot, Ynet. So this is what they're spreading out, and some secrecy, by the way. If they were really going to do this, would they actually announce it to the whole country and the whole world, ultimately? But they're also preparing for missiles in the north from Hezbollah, which, by the way, is a worse threat than Hamas. They've got much stronger missiles that can hit Tel Aviv. There's no word about Syria. For some reason or another, I didn't see the word Syria in this, and there should be. Okay? Syria gets involved, and you've got another 50,000 missiles aimed at you. But they're also preparing, besides riots in the West Bank, missiles in the north, and of course Hamas, which they're attacking in Gaza Strip. But they also forgot a very major player today, and I just wrote about them in an article I called I'm Down, I'm Really Down. Nonetheless, the Israeli Arabs, who are a fifth column and a noisy fifth column, and this is going to be a war. And I'll tell you, if it's a true blue war, you don't use rubber bullets. You shoot if it's a war. And Israeli Arabs are going to be involved, whether surreptitiously or in some covert way. But this is one very complicated war. If this is what they're releasing to the Israeli public, it just means outright that this is going to be an all-out war from every single border. There's going to be trouble. The army is demoralized enough, but we're talking about quelling riots in the West Bank, stopping Hezbollah missiles, which they failed miserably to do a year and a half ago in July. And this is not even to mention Hamas, which is a true blue army today. This is going to be not the Six-Day War. This is going to be just massive trouble. And that's what the IDF has released, their war plan. This was just 2 days ago, by the way. And a lot of it is connected to a plan to attack the Gaza Strip and put the rockets out of commission. But a lot of it is the war drums coming out of the killing of Mugni as well. So, I mean, really, this is really becoming serious. I think that we should see some sort of a genuine war within literally a couple of weeks. I may be wrong about the timing, but it feels like the pot is about to boil over.
Well, I agree with you. Apparently, there's a fellow named Nasrallah who heads Hezbollah, and he's saying that it's going to have to be an attack on Israel as well. And apparently, he's pretty well connected up there in Lebanon, but he really heads Hezbollah, doesn't he?
Well, that's from Damascus.
Right.
He's been hiding from the Israelis for a year and a half.
Okay.
Which means Syria is going to be involved. This is going to be a bad war. Just a nasty one.
Well, because there's no such thing as a good war. That's the tragedy.
The Six-Day War was over in 6 days.
Right.
That's a good war. A two-week rocket war minimum is starting to get, bogged down in a lot of violence. That's what we have to look forward to in the next war. No grand Israeli victory. The people don't believe the army can do it anymore. It's just a new Israel that's going to have a lot of human sacrifice, and that's the part I'm worried about. As I have said before, my family and friends are going to be fighting this war, and some will be victimized, I'm afraid.
Hey, man, hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment with Barry Shammas. All right, Barry, go ahead and pick up the story there.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that. I said I'd do the overall. That's the overall. I'm going to now discuss You've got Bye Bye Gaza, right?
I've got it sitting right in front of me with the pictures there, and I even saw the picture of the car you told me to look at.
Page 26 and 27.
Right.
27 is where they found the body.
Right.
All right. Now we're going to talk about the murder of Raful Eitan in November 23rd of the year 04. Now,
what was the fellow's name again?
Raful Eitan.
Okay.
Well, we called him Raful. Rafael is the official name, but Raful is what he was known as to all Israelis. He was my chief of staff during the Lebanon War of 1982. And Sharon was defense minister and chose Eitan to be his chief of staff. And this man... had a party called Somet. The last time I ever voted in an Israeli election, it was Fort Somet. And that just about was so heartbreaking. They became the third leading party in parliament. Rabin stole two crooks, Goldfarb and Segev, to get the Oslo War Accord passed through parliament. And Eitan was destroyed politically when it turns out that he stole $450,000 of party funds to build his mistress a house. And apparently this story is true. He never denied it. So he had a very tragic political career. Certainly I wasn't the only one who just stopped voting when Somet was proven to be so rotten. But nonetheless, he remained very respected in spite of all this. Now, just to give you a little background, he was opening his mouth against Sharon. In my book, Bye Bye Gaza, you'll read parts of his last interview in Tel Aviv magazine where he said Sharon is making a historic mistake with the Gush Katif pullouts, and he says, and I can prove it. He had information on Sharon. He had lots of information on Sharon, and that made him a tremendous target for murder. That murder took place the night after a storm in November 23rd, as I said. Now, Eitan was the contractor for the Ashdod Port Authority. He was building new breakwaters and expanding the ports. He got this job in 03. How he became an engineer, nobody knows. He was a general. But he got this fancy job. Now, this is the official report. You have the pictures, and we'll talk about what was done to this poor man. Officially, according to the company building the port, it was called Jubilee Port. Officially, he phoned at 7 in the morning, and they heard a tremendous wave.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Barry is telling us a story about this gentleman who's very well thought of in Israel. He had a few unfortunate involvements with some dishonest manipulation of things, but he certainly was an Israeli general. His name was Raful Eitan, or Raful, or Raful, I guess they call him Eitan. And of course, now he's got a lot of information about Sharon and the corruption of Sharon, and he's speaking out against, of course, what's going on, and certainly against the pullout of Gaza. He feels it's going to be a terrible, terrible mistake, and so now he's working, of course, as an engineer who is building a major port, or at least expanding a breakwater and creating a port for Israel. And tell us the story from there on, Barry.
Well, officially, he's on the phone to the company, to the engineering company, building the port at 7 in the morning. They hear a wave, if you can imagine hearing a wave over a cell phone and knowing it was a wave, but that's what they claimed. They heard a giant wave, and then the phone cut off, and supposedly that's when the ocean swallowed up Rafule Tan. The only problem is the workers at Ashdod Port all signed police testimonies that they saw Raful at 8 o'clock. Now, immediately when I heard this, bells started ringing. I mean, anyone who investigates crime and sees such a blatant problem with the timing of the death knows that something is wrong immediately. And there were lots of initial questions, like what was he doing at the very edge of a breakwater on a stormy morning? Why was he arriving at the port at 7 in the morning anyways, when the port didn't even open to workers until 8 o'clock? There were lots and lots of reasonable questions, which I noted. I wrote them down. But the next day, I had the proof that I needed, that he was killed, and I knew how it was done. Look at picture one. Now, people, you can't look at the pictures. You have to buy bye-bye gas. So it's the only way. There are two pictures that were released to the newspaper Yediot Akronot. One is of a town. On page 26, we see his car is thoroughly smashed. Okay? The roof is caved in on the, not quite the driver's side, a little away, like a foot and a half away from the driver. There is a massive hole in the roof. And I said to myself, no wave is going to make a hole in a car's roof like that. That, you know, I asked people throughout Israel, I laminated these pictures, and I said, have you ever heard of a wave doing that to a car in this country? And no one ever did. No one ever lost their friend to a wave hitting a car. But it was worse. The car is parallel parked. Let's say the wave hit it. Well, it shouldn't still be parallel parked. At a minimum, the wave should have moved the car. But then Dr. Stan, look on the left side of this picture. You'll see the water is completely calm. And it should be. He's on a breakwater. A breakwater has two sides. It's got the rough side and it's got the calm side. That's why they call them breakwaters. There is the ripple in the side where he supposedly fell in. Now, look on the car, and as I said, listeners, you can't do this. You have to buy the book to look at the car. But look at the car that on the opposite side, the left-hand side of the car, where the wave didn't hit. Do you see how smashed up it is all over the place?
Well, it doesn't look that bad to me.
You'll see.
And then the left-hand side of the car, as I was sitting in the front seat, that would be the side
the
that we
door,
can...
the fender, the bumper. It's
oh,
all
yeah, okay.
smashed
yeah,
up.
That, yeah, there is a certainly a large dent there. You're right.
There's lots of large dents. Hold on, I'm going to get the picture after this. I'm going to guide you through the picture.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Barry Samuelson. Of course, if supposedly the wave came, if it had hit the car, it would have hit it on the left side, and if it coming in on the but on the right side is there's a breakwater enclosure, and of course the wave was supposedly would have hit from the left side, but then it's the right side of the roof that smashed in. So something about the story isn't quite right, which is the point Barry's trying to make. But this was a man who spoke out about what was going on in government, and the next thing you know, he's very dead. And if you don't think that happens here in America, well, let me tell you, you're very mistaken. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're just talking about this Rafael Eitan, and of course he was an Israeli general who was very upset by the fact that they were going to give up Gaza, and of course this, and Sharon was going to do it. He was going to blow the whistle, and suddenly he dies, but under mysterious circumstances. Go ahead with the story, Barry.
All right, I'm looking at the picture now. Now, the biggest hit is on the roof.
Yeah, right. And, of course, the right side of the roof is caved in. The left side of the roof is not so much.
Yes. But look at the bumper and look at the doors on the left-hand side. Yeah, look at the windows.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I can see the bumper. I should see the fender on the left front wheel, the left door. Certainly looks like it's been hit.
No wave can make sharp punctures like that in the car.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
I'll tell you what happened, but let's switch over to the next page. Here is where they found Eitan's body.
Right.
Now look at the waves. That is the exposed side of the breakwater.
Right.
That is the Israeli naval base 1.5 kilometers away. That's where the body was found.
I see, okay.
Okay, now that we have that, we can ask the questions. How did his body get a mile and kilometer and a half away? But it gets even worse. Now, I'm going to jump forward to a speech I gave with an amazing guest that showed up. Now, I've been hammering at this for, let's say, 2 weeks. And when I gave speeches, I handed out the pictures, and I just asked people, I just said outright, do you believe a wave did that to the car? And nobody thought a wave could do that to a car.
And of course, the thing is that here you see over the left front bumper, it looks like you know it was hit because it's almost a right angle indentation there in the fender. Go right ahead.
Well, it looks like it was hit by something very, very sharp.
Right.
Look, what happened to Eitan was he arrived at the port and they were going to kill him by having a crane. It was going to be an industrial accident. A crane was going to drop a heavy block on the car and kill him. And that's what they did. They dropped something high and they smashed that car from above. That was the murder. And they were going to claim that he was murdered in a work accident. The problem is that look at how it just missed the driver. It's about a foot away from being accurate. He would have survived that hit.
All right, hold on. We'll be back right in just a moment. Our guest, of course, is Barry Samus. We're talking about the picture in his book, Bye Bye Gaza. And, of course, what we're supposedly told is that this man was hit. He and the car were hit by a gigantic wave, and somehow his body is found a mile and a half away. But if you look at the car, it's very obvious that something had fallen on the roof, and something had hit the car from the left side. Something very, very sharp to create an angular impression in the left front fender, and of course, damage done to the left side of the car. But the major damage is done to the roof. The left side of the roof, probably the right side of the roof, away from the driver, is mashed in. Go right ahead.
It would have been a fine murder.
Right.
He's going there to inspect the port. It's windy. Crane gives way. He smashes his car. That's the end of him. That's how you create that enormous indenture on the roof. It's from above something heavy. And by the way, I had wave engineers all the way from California even send me their analyses of the pictures and everything. I prepared this quite well. But let us go forward. I'm giving a lecture in Elkhana. It was a great lecture. There were over 100 people. And lo and behold, at the end of the lecture, a man stands up. It is Gidon Shamir. He's the Director General of the Israeli Ports Authority. He's in charge of all the ports, and he's at the lecture, and he looks at the pictures, and he says, "No, I've misinterpreted. Yes, I'm absolutely right that on the right-hand side of the picture, or at least our left, the right-hand side for Eitan, was quiet, and that was the quiet side of the breakwater. But what's missing in the picture is the other side of the breakwater where the wave must have hit. And it would have taken Eitan and thrown him into the calm water. And I panicked. You know, I panic. I had the biggest guy in the country, the Ports Authority Director General, questioning what I was saying. Now, there was a lot of conversation where I was sinking, and then I said to him, if this wave hit the car and smashed all the windows, why is there no debris on the road? Now, Dr. Stan, look at the road. It's absolutely clear of glass.
Right, you're right.
And he says to me, when I got there, there was plenty of glass. And then I said to myself, I don't know, it was just a vision of what to ask him. So I said, well, where is it now? And he gets very flustered. And he says, no, I'm wrong. There was no glass. The wave took it into the ocean.
So he's playing it by ear. He's obviously there to discredit you.
Oh, no question. His answers were prepared. He had all the advantages. He knew what to answer me before he even got there. He explained that once a year there's a massive wave and it pushes tractors. And then, now, the ball is in my court now. And someone from the audience who says he's an engineer stands up. I remember he was in his 30s, he was tall, and he says to me and the audience, because by the way, the audience are very intensely listening to this right now. It's the lecturer Barry Chalmers against Gideon Shamir, the head of the Ports Authority of Israel. You don't get that every day. And he says, look, we had a tsunami in Asia, and we saw what a tsunami does to cars. He said no car that didn't fall into the water looked like Eitan's car. He said they were all pushed by the water. They weren't smashed by the water. And he says a car is like a boat, with the engine being the anchor. The car would normally float if it wasn't for the engine. Now, he says that Eitan's car is parallel parked. He says that is not possible if a wave hits the car. It should have been the other way around, with the light side facing against the wave and the motor facing towards where the wave was. And he explained the whole thing. And Mr. Shamir is getting very, very upset. And then I saw my moment. And I said, you say that the wave took him from the... First of all, the wave hit from the seaside first and smashed into Eitan and threw him into the quiet side of the breakwater where he smashed his head and drowned. That was his story. I said, okay, let's say that's true. Then I take out the second picture of where they found the body. Will you please turn to page 27?
Yeah, I've got it right in front of me. 28, actually.
28, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Do you see the water?
You're right. It's just sort of a boiling there
It's roiling. And that would be an hour after, supposedly. It depends on the timing,
right,
whether it happened at 7 or at 8, but they found the body at 9. On the other side... So I said to Mr. Shamir, I said, how is it if the wave took him and threw him into the quiet side of the breakwater that the body floated a mile and a half away to the other side, the seaside of the breakwater, took him from the quiet side and somehow floated him to the seaside where he floated a mile and a half away? I said, if he had been thrown into the breakwater, into the harbor itself, wouldn't he have just stayed in place? And Mr. Shamir became very, very quiet and pale. And I said to him, how would the body have got on the other side of the breakwater, the seaside. And he said somebody would have had to have placed it there. That's what he told the whole audience. And I said, who would do such a thing?
And what was his response to that?
Now, his response was amazing. He said, I don't know, by the way. Right after that, he said, I don't know. But the lecture essentially ended on this amazing high note where I came out. Obviously, the truth was not the way Gidon Shamir had wanted to present it. And then I sell my books. I made an okay living in Israel. Every lecture, I just sold out my books. And he comes up to me, and he says, here's his exact words in Hebrew. It won't be in Hebrew. I'll do it in English. He says to me, what was the motive? That was all. Those were his final words to me. What was the motive?
And did you tell him that they had to silence him?
I went back to selling books. I was thrilled that he was decent and honest enough to actually ask me, why did they kill Eitan? Now, the story goes on. I've decided that I am going to actually pursue this. I've learned a little from Rabin. I had a couple of students from the biggest art school in Israel. It's called the Bezalel Academy of Art. They want to film me for a class project. And they want to talk to me about Rabin and, you know, the usual stuff. I said, I've got a surprise for you tonight. They were two young girls, 23 or so. I said, I've got a real surprise for you tonight. We're going to the police. So I gathered up my pictures and the testimonies and the newspaper reports and the timing. And the reason was the government assigned a commission of inquiry. It was headed by the Ashdod port director general. His name was Shaul Rotem. It met for 2 hours. And decided that Rafael was swept by a wave and drowned. Nobody brought up the timing issue. Nobody brought up that the company said that they heard the wave over the cell phone and Eitan was there at 7 when the workers testified that he arrived at 8. What was he doing at the edge of a breakwater? How did his car get smashed by a wave this way? None of it was brought up. 3 hours later, end of commission. I went to the police with a camera crew, Modi'in police, and we filmed me submitting a police complaint against Shaul Rotem for covering up a public commission of inquiry into the murder, alleged murder, of Raful Eitan. And by the way, the police looked at my complaint and my evidence and my pictures. They knew what was going on. They knew, but we got special attention because in came a camera crew to make this complaint and just to make sure that everyone knew this complaint was made. I now had a police complaint against Shaul Rotem claiming that Raful was murdered. Which, by the way, in any honest world, would have been investigated, and they would have found so many open questions that the thing would have been investigated thoroughly. But these girls did not expect this, and you can be sure they, you know, these are leftist artists. They were going to show up and probably find some way to demean what I do, but they got themselves some real drama because the police let me in first. They filmed this. They did not film me submitting the complaint. The police wouldn't allow them to do that. They filmed me going into the investigation room, the interrogation room. I now have a complaint on film against the Port Authority for covering up the investigation. And this I put over the Internet. Now, I want you to know something. I never heard from the police again. Never. Not a dismissal. Not a letter saying that there was no basis to my complaint. Nothing. I never heard from the police ever again, which was different than the Rabin stuff where they would get back to me with stupid denials. Well, let's not get into that. This time they didn't even want to answer the complaint. But the complaint made the news, and it got to someone very, very big. It got Bookie, what's his name? Bookie Na'er is a major columnist for Yediot Achronot. And he phoned me up. Actually, his assistant, Tao, phoned me up and says that Bookie wants to meet with me. And we met in Tel Aviv, and I brought the evidence, as well as all kinds of material for him to read. We had a long, good meeting. I felt we had a very successful meeting. And he says, believe me, what I know, I agree with you about this and that, this. I've seen it all. And we'll do something about Eitan. Never heard from him ever again. I phoned once. There was not a return answer. And that was that. They covered up the murder of Raful Eitan thoroughly. They didn't make the same mistakes they made with Rabin, where they would deny it based on false denials. Now, a very strange thing happened. Now, remember, I'm being very noisy about Raful. Again, the lessons of Rabin have taught me to be noisy, or it goes away, which eventually it did. But an amazing thing happened. Oh, I was already in America. No, I wasn't. I was still in Israel. When Raful's wife went on national television, and she made a remarkable, remarkable statement. Now, I'm going to remind, I have to go back first just once with Gideon Shamir. I asked Shamir the same question. Do you believe that the marks on the left side of the car were made by a wave? Which, of course, is impossible. I mean, look at the door and look at the bumper. These are very sharp marks. They're not water marks. And he said, no, of course not. But he threw me off with the answer he gave. Raful was a very bad driver, and he made those marks in accidents before he got to the port. And I had no answer to that. Maybe he was a bad driver and made those marks beforehand. I didn't have an answer to that. But now we go to Raful Eitan's wife is on TV, national TV, and she's reminiscing about her husband, and she says something that my readers knew was staged and written for. She said that Raful was a very bad driver and had ruined three cars in 18 months before he died. It was his third car, she says, in 18 months because he was that bad a driver. Now, first of all, that car was more than a year and a half old. We can start with that right from the beginning. His license would have been taken away if he had wrecked three cars in 18 months. That statement was scripted to explain those pictures. And to, because there were rumors floating, and you can thank me for the rumors because the rest of the Israeli media were just absolutely worthless on this, as usual, as usual. I went on radio and I told them, again, they tried to make a mockery of it, but I had the evidence. And radio shows would hear me out and said, you know what? They would say in Hebrew, it sounds like you could be right. And I did this until Mrs. Eitan went on TV and said her husband was such a crappy driver that he wrecked three cars in 18 months. This was the murder of a critic of the disengagement who knew Sharon intimately. When Sharon was in Sabra and Shatila letting the Falangists massacre 800 Palestinians, he was the chief of staff at the time. He knew that Sharon kept the Falangists in there for 3 days, and he knew there was a massacre taking place.
All right, for our listeners out there, this is the massacre that occurred in Lebanon that, of course, had served to discredit Ben-Gurion, is that right?
No, no, Sharon.
Oh, this is, okay.
Sharon, Sabra Shatila was the massacre over 3 days by the Lebanese phalangist army that ultimately was used to discredit Menachem Begin and get him out of power.
Okay, fine, okay. All right, fine. We'll be going to be back in just a moment with to wrap up today's program. Our guest has been Barry Shamus. Barry, let's get your telephone number out, your website.
All right, to get the books, they're about $25 each for Bye Bye Gaza and less for the others if you don't buy them in color. Go to lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com, and you can see the pictures of the cars. My website is the Barry Chambers website, but BarryChambers.com will get you there. When you're at Lulu, I forgot, it says search. Write in C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's how you spell Chambers. And do I still have time for the phone number?
We'll get that when we get back here.
Gotcha.
All right, go right ahead with the story.
All right, let's do this slower. For you to see the pictures of a Cannes car and know how it was done, get Bye Bye Gaza. Go to lulu.com and write C-H-A-M-I-S-H under search. Don't get the color book. It's expensive, although it is very attractive. The black and white book is about $22-$23, and you'll know all about these murders. Website is BarryChambers.com, and I have a series of DVDs, and if you phone me, I'll talk to you about them. My number is 904-501-7605. That's 904-501-7605. The latest is an MP3, The Best of Barry 2007, with 124 radio shows. That's 5 days of listening for $20 plus a present. Now, I understand you were on George Ann's show this week.
Right, we were.
Well, how did it go?
It went very well. I thought, at least I think it went well.
She's a very charming lady. I'm on her show tomorrow. I'm the one that handed out your number.
Well, I appreciate that, and we enjoyed being with her.
Well, with Georgiana, I'm a little lighter than I am with you, but how much time do we have left?
We got about a minute.
Well, then this is done. I'll see you tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, and we'll talk about the murder of Rafule Tan. By our third show, you'll be an expert on it, and we'll understand why the corruption of Israel's leadership is just going to lead to the downfall of this country unless they're overturned in a mighty big hurry.
Amen to that. Well, we'll be looking forward to talking to you tomorrow morning early. Your 10 o'clock
it.
Your time, 7 o'clock my time. Good night, Barry. God bless. Thanks
night
very
all.
Much. Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Barry Shamus, and Barry always brings up some fascinating subjects. And isn't it interesting that there's an earthquake in Israel this last week, and it just hits two places. One is Joseph's tomb, and the other, that's in Samaria. And then the other is the Temple Mount. And there's a big hole in the Temple Mount now. What does this foretell? Does God play a part in it? I believe God plays a part in everything. And I believe that this foretells something. I don't know what it is. But I think that we're moving into very, very difficult times as far as Israel is concerned. I think it's only a matter of time before there will be a major war in the Near East. And of course, going along with that may come a massive missile attack on Israel, which by normal means will completely destroy the nation. But remember, Israel is not a normal nation. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoyed our program with Barry, especially his reference to the fact that there was a major earthquake this last week. And it only hit two parts of the country. One was Joseph's tomb, and the other, of course, was certainly there on Temple Mount. We've seen pictures of it. Great big hole in the Temple Mount, certainly about halfway between the Mosque of Omar and the Al-Aqsa tomb. Why would you only get damage and done in two places if there's a major earthquake? Well, maybe God's telling us something. I don't know what it is, but believe me, between man's plan in time and God's plan in eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. Well, this is the time when we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help to maintain the outlets. We have almost 60 outlets every week, or some of them are shortwave, some of them are internet, some of them are certainly on radio stations, and then, of course, we have the internet, and fortunately, we have both Genesis Internet and Radio Liberty Internet, and we're reaching a growing number of people because our listeners are telling other people about our programs, and they're listening in, and they start out thinking we're crazy, and before long, they're afraid we're not. Under any circumstances, we hope that if you're able at all to help us, you'll give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WARP. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will be interested in getting the latest DVD we put out. It's entitled The Plan Police State. And it simply explains to you how there really is a plan for a dictatorship here in America. You'll hear a congressman talking about that plan. And, of course, another congressman trying to bring out the fact that there's a plan to suspend the Constitution and round up Americans and put them into concentration camps. You'll actually see the film footage on that. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get my interview with Ambassador Earl T. Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time of the Cuban Revolution. He'll tell you how the American State Department and the President and everybody knew in Washington that Fidel Castro was a communist, and that's why we brought him to power. You'll see my interview. It's called World Revolution. It's available on video or DVD. World Revolution. Nothing is it appears to be. And, of course, you think that we are trying to get rid of Fidel Castro? Certainly, if you read Ron Paul's farewell address in 1984, you'll find out we were doing everything we could to finance the companies for keeping Fidel Castro in power, and we're still keeping him in power, or at least his regime in power. But we can't let the American people know that any more than we can let them know what Sybil Edmonds has brought out. You get these articles off the London Times website in London, and that is that the American government is doing everything they can to spread nuclear technology to the Islamic nations, to Pakistan, and that information is being given to Iran, to Libya, and to North Korea. We're really spreading knowledge as to how to build nuclear weapons to the Islamic world. Why would you be doing that while at the same time you're trying to convince the American people that we're trying to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons into countries that would be irresponsible? Well, ladies and gentlemen, nothing is it appears to be. And that, of course, is a Sybil Edmonds story. You can pull them down on certainly out of the London Times. And they've done everything they could to suppress this story. We do hope that many of you go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, read our newsletters there, and listen to our programs, which are archived, and watch the DVDs that are there free of charge. And then, of course, we also hope that many of you want to get our new four CD set on the Bilderbergers, our new four tape set on the spy chips, our new 4D CD or four tape set on weather modification. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they know how to modify the weather. We also have a book on that, and we have a DVD on weather modification. Understand that they're not being forthcoming. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-44-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.